ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm speaking with Michael Scott, CRO for True Optic, a VC-funded startup providing data management, measurement, and activation solutions for advertisers and media companies in the fastest-growing over-the-top industry. Michael has spent a career in various marketing industries, including television, sports, custom content, and analytics. His varied experience has earned him a reputation as the consummate marketer to marketers. Prior to joining True Optic, Michael ran all revenue, partnerships, and business development for Gamut, a wholly owned digital media subsidiary of Cox Media Group. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Excited to be here today.
Fantastic. For listeners who aren't familiar with True Optic, could you describe what your core businesses are and who you serve?
Thanks, Gabrielle. And it's great to be here today. So True Optic is an over-the-top television data company. So when people think about over-the-top television, the best way to think about it is your Roku player or watching a Netflix program or some kind of television program or even movies that aren't going through the traditional channels like your cable box or even over-the-air television. And so our business is helping both advertisers as well as media companies understand the audience trends so they can provide more effective advertising to those people and they can provide more interesting content to consumers. So it's really taken the evolution of the most powerful device in a home from a content perspective and really bringing it forward throughout the 21st century.
So would that also include things when traditional broadcasters and things do an over-the-top service like a CBS All Access, that stuff, that would also be included in what you do?
Absolutely, yes. So CBS All Access, the NBCU, what's called TV Everywhere apps, and then pure play apps like a Crackle, or a Crunchyroll or a Tubi TV, any of these that are built specifically for the over-the-top universe as it is.
And is the consumer aware of what you're doing, or is this really, it's purely a business-to-business thing? I mean, do you provide search functionality, or is it really more about doing rich data mining for businesses who are looking to serve advertising?
Yeah, we are a business-to-business service provider, and you know the end result for consumers is hopefully they have a more engaging ad experience, that they're not being peppered with irrelevant or annoying ads,
right,
and that they're also being able to find and discover through their profile and their consumption patterns, you know, content that's most relevant to them and content that they would enjoy.
So how are you getting your data? How are you pulling that? Is it based on the companies you're working with, like the Roku, they feed your data in and then you recombine it and make it useful? Or are you pulling data from another location?
No, we're actually pulling data on behalf of the publishers themselves or the media companies. So a company like Crackle, who's owned by Sony, would hire us and they would put our technology inside of their app. And anytime any consumer is watching that app, whether it's on a Roku device or whether it's on their smartphone or whether it's on a laptop, we're able to collect the viewing patterns and the viewing behavior of that. Of course, everything's anonymous, so I wouldn't know.
I was just going to say, like, what are the privacy implications there?
Privacy implications are that we never trade in any kind of personally identifiable information. So I wouldn't know that it was you, Gabriella, watching any program in particular. All of our data is anonymized at the household level. Mm-hmm. And then provided more broad-based consumption patterns. So here's the type of profile of the people that may be watching dramas on NBC or maybe watching comedy programs on Crackle and things of that nature. And so we work on behalf of the media companies themselves. And everything that we do is in a passive format. And it's much like any kind of measurement that would happen on a website that you visit or on a mobile app that you use.
I see. Okay. And so when you're talking about making the ad experience less
horrible, for lack of a better term. Does that also mean that you're making sure that I'm not seeing the same ad over and over again, that there's variety? I mean, is that part of the service, that it's like, oh, we've already seen this Geico ad, so we're not going to serve that one up again? How granular is it in that sense?
I think you'll continue to see Geico ads because Geico buys a lot of ads.
Well, but is it a different
Geico ad? No, that's more of poking a little bit of fun. So what that is that's what they call in the advertising business frequency. And how many times did this person or this household see an ad? The nice thing that can be done with our technology is to be able to do something called frequency cap, which is know that any household needs to see an ad 3 times to begin to understand the message, 7 times before it makes an impact. But then at 10 times, you're really into the law of diminishing returns. And at 12 times, you're probably doing some damage to the brand to see that same ad. And the interesting thing in the over-the-top applications, you know, the apps that people use when they're in an Apple TV or a Roku environment or even on their smartphone, is a much more intimate and it's less commercial inventory. So those commercials have to work even harder. But they do because they're better targeted and they're in a less crowded advertising space, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I actually was curious about that because there aren't really, I mean, a lot of the whole point, you know, if you're subscribing to certain over-the-top services is you don't have advertisements, I thought.
Yeah, and so that's one part of, you know, the service that we provide, right, is being smarter and more intuitive about the advertising and how the advertising can be targeted and really presented in a meaningful way to consumers. Now, if you're an app that's a subscriber only, you know, you don't carry any advertising, then you're probably using our technology to better understand some consumer behavior and some consumer patterns to better understand what kind of content.
That was my next question is, okay, I'm a media company. How, you know, fine, this is helping me, if I'm ad supported, this is helping me better do that. But how does it relate to what I'm producing and knowing the appetites better?
Yeah, so, you know, think about the, because we're able to capture at a very individual level, again, with no personally identifiable information, but knowing to create really granular profiles. So instead of just people who watch a Wednesday night comedy on ABC or also like a Thursday night drama on NBC, we can get into even very, very granular specifics. As a matter of fact, one of the projects that we worked with on a global advertising agency who was working on behalf of one of their film and entertainment clients was getting into even micro genre graphs of being able to understand what do people who watch this horror film and this romantic comedy have in common? And being able to draw together these inferences and these insights that, you know what it is, these two things, they have a really strong female lead. So that's kind of the common conduit from that. And from that, can start building out better insights, not only about what programming they should be looking to present to the viewer, but also the programming that they should be looking to create. And just basing a lot more about that. So the end experience for the consumer ultimately is something where the advertising is more relevant to your life and the content is a little bit more relevant to your personal tastes.
So sort of the affinity, where your affinities would lie. Question though, if I'm one of the things we've seen a lot and why discoverability is tricky is the walled gardens, their secret sauce is the viewing data, you know? If I'm NBC and I've signed up with you, I don't necessarily want ABC to know about my stuff and how it's doing and how it might apply to what they're doing. I mean, how do you navigate that kind of stuff with the content providers who participate?
Yeah, and so that's a great question. So everything that we do on behalf of the content providers is essentially a walled garden. So it's their proprietary data. So it's not being shared unless they want it to be shared. And typically, they're not going to share it with the other networks or other media companies so they can maintain a competitive advantage or the insights that they're getting. And that's truly now, you know, one of the things that we're seeing in the industry is this continued prevalence of walled gardens. I don't see that really going away as anything. I see the walls getting higher and the gardens getting more lush and
yeah, good.
And being fortified a bit more.
Well, because, yeah. It's where your secrets are.
And, you know, and I think from a consumer experience, look, the two biggest names in the interactive space, you know, Google and Facebook have walled gardens and they don't share their data with anyone. Mm-hmm. Everything has to be used and activated on their platform. But it's a really relevant advertising experience if you're on Facebook that you're seeing ads about things that you're interested in or things that are relevant to your life. So there is a positive and there is a negative. The negatives tend to be tied up in people who don't have access to any data and they want to have access to that data. But it is also one of, you know, these a lot of these companies, it's their proprietary, you know, intellectual property. And it's part of the user agreement. So, you know, the fact that they're not sharing it just continues to give them more of a robust strategic advantage. Well, I don't see that going away anyway.
How did that work, though, for your client who was interested in what are the affinity cross points? How did you overcome that issue for that, where, you know, the horror, strong female lead, you know, thing?
Great question. So we also have another business. So what we've just been talking to is how things are kind of transacted in the commercial over-the-top television space.
Right.
But what if you couldn't find that? What if there are these walled gardens? So we've also developed a technology that looks into how people are file sharing globally content and being able to understand and measure that consumption at a very, very granular and tidal level. So our understanding of any one program at a very wide scale in the hundreds of millions of people, we are able to take those data points and start stitching that together.
Right. Now, so this is really where the origin of your company started, right? This is the sort of first service you had was looking at the peer-to-peer marketplace. Is that
correct? Precisely. And you know, this is our business is about 3.5 years old. And we started out looking for the largest set of unmeasured media consumption data. And we knew that there was a lot of data, a lot of consumption that was happening in the open OTT. You call it the also known as the peer-to-peer file sharing, which is powered by the BitTorrent protocol. And it allows users around the globe to be able to share files. In some countries, it's illegal. In some countries, it's legal. And in some countries, it's somewhere in between. Regardless of the legality of the practice, our interest was in being able to help entertainment companies and media companies really understand how consumption is happening, especially for titles that are outside the walled gardens. And by virtue of scale, about 70% of the consumption that happens on any one title, whether it's a TV program or it's a movie for television, is happening in this open OTT ecosystem. So if you think about a pie chart, only 30% is happening in the licensed platforms. 70% of the consumption is happening off platform in a peer-to-peer environment.
Well, that's exactly that. That squares exactly with what we found with young millennials and the piracy. I know that to your
point, it wasn't
always piracy, but you know, in the way we were looking at it, it was piracy. So I'm not surprised at all by the number. The percentage. What do you have a current number to attach to that? Just to have a sort of an order of magnitude. I saw an old number, and I think it was 500 million or something.
Yeah. So we see approximately 10 billion data passage points a day. So any one file, any one TV show, the Game of Thrones most recent season finale, may be connected and shared among, you know, tens of millions of people. That's all happening in milliseconds every day. And we're seeing all of that happening about 10 billion times, little bits of the files happening every day. Put in a different scale, around the globe, we see every month 500 million households consuming peer-to-peer content. In the United States, that number is 30 million, which sounds kind of strange when you think about it, because the United States is so large and such a big media and entertainment consumer. But there's so much available in the United States. Some of the markets we see are markets where there isn't readily available or content may be embargoed. So ironically enough, yeah. So we see in Australia, we see a large percentage in Australia because movies and television shows tend to be embargoed for a number of months before they premiere in Australia.
Right. Which is huge. The rights issues there. So this isn't just to clarify, because we've talked to number of people who look at popularity. This is not, these are not proxies. This is actual straight popularity. You're looking household by household, right? So you can really,
we can look and we can look and identify again in an anonymous way, not knowing that it would be John Smith, but we can look and say that this household that we've identified has watched, streamed all seasons of Game of Thrones, has watched House of Cards, has downloaded these five Oscar award-winning films. And we also look at music and video games, because anything that's digital can be traded through these pipes. So, and we know that they're Beyonce fans or something like that. So we begin to profile and be able to connect a lot of different media consumption, but overwhelmingly the data that we're providing and our main clients for, interestingly enough, are the people whose content tends to be pirated are buying our data. So it's if it's a, I don't know if it's a, if you can't beat them, join them kind of world, but I think they probably realize it's a lot easier to, you know,
well, they need to capture the information one way or another, I suppose. I guess one of the things I am curious about, though, is the, in the United States, the profile of the person who is doing the peer-to-peer behavior isn't representative of the population at large. And does that in any way skew the data? I mean, they tend to be slightly more male, slightly younger. And so then are their viewing interests or habits different from the larger population?
So we've actually seen some data where we've taken our data, and again, we can tie it back to individual households and then compare that household data with third-party commercial household data, like Experian. So people are familiar with Experian, who knows everything about every household in the United States.
It's super
creepy. I don't want to scare people.
it's really creepy.
If you're on Facebook, you've already made that deal and you've made your bed and now you have to lie in it. So don't worry about Experian.
Yes.
That's right.
It's awful. So,
but it is super creepy. But the less creepy part of it is that we're able to take a profile of Game of Thrones users, and to give you some indication, the Game of Thrones finale last year, the night it was premiering at 9 p.m. on HBO in the Eastern time zone, we received 8.9 million requests for that file.
Wow.
That's a significant number. But what just back to your point about the age and composition, what we've done is we've taken it because we don't know the person individually. We just know that they're at a household.
Right.
And we've matched that household with Experian's data. And Experian's given us some profiles of that household. And interestingly enough, the household composition is pretty in line with the U.S. Census. Now, that may not.
Yeah, but in my household, I know who the pirate is in my household, and it is not me.
Okay.
It is not anybody who actually controls the pocketbook. I mean, quite honestly, it's the drain upon the pocketbook. But
correct. But what's interesting is that, and this kind of flies in the face of not wanting to pay for it, is that the one statistic that we saw, so we saw household composition, age, and gender was pretty much aligned. You might see it on an individual level being skewing younger and skewing male.
Right.
That's fine. But the one that we saw that you may not have seen is the household income in the United States over-indexed by 30%.
I'm not surprised actually by that.
Well, we think you need a pretty robust pipe coming in, right?
Exactly.
So that's expensive. You usually have a few electronic toys, so those are expensive. The other thing that we saw is that these are robust media consumers, right? So this isn't somebody like me, for instance, who has a DVR that's backed up with programs from last summer. These are people who can't find enough. And oftentimes, they'd be more than happy to pay for the content if the content was available. So
right.
They might be looking for, we see a lot of, you know, expats. So Indians in the United States streaming Bollywood.
Right.
And Russians streaming Russian programming. So it's less about paying for it. And I think more, don't get me wrong, there's still people who are not paying for it. But it's
access. It's access. And it's also, it's access and it's of ease of access. You know, that you don't have to travel a million different places, a million different passwords. It's your experience, your user interface, or at least those are the things that we've found in what we've looked at. And the other thing is the mythology around the millennial being the stingy one in the household. It's usually actually the slightly older generation, which is more price sensitive than the younger folks.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting, there's interesting lessons, right, for the media and entertainment, especially for the studios. And, you know, a lot of the titles that we see that are shared in peer-to-peer happen to be titles that are active right now in the theatrical release. They haven't even had their, you know, digital release yet.
Right.
So what does that say about some of the initiatives that they're trying to balance maybe with, you know, same day release in home on pay-per-view, right? For $50, $75 price point. I talk to the studios. I know some of the things that they're, you know, they're interested in. And it's this constant battle that we're in. Anytime you have, you know, some sort of technology that is transformative, is how do I keep my old business model, but how do I embrace the new one? And how do I have my feet in kind of two different places at once?
Right. Well, for your own, so that's sort of what they're struggling with. The question I have for you is, how do you future-proof your business? I mean, is there, what's the barrier to entry to another party coming in and measuring these sites?
Well, first off, people had been trying to do what we've done in the BitTorrent world for 14 years, and our tech team accomplished it in 4 months. So it's a very difficult thing.
So you've got the magic brains.
We've got some magic brains. We've got some smart brains. Fortunately, not me. They don't want me on the whiteboard. But more than that, I think, is the ability for us to kind of get this data at a census level. So, you know, the media companies can use our data as they go into a new market or trying to understand competitive trends. Mm-hmm. And I even have people who are OTT platforms who are using it kind of in a Moneyball way, meaning right. Where's the demand and what content can I buy that has the largest impact for the least amount of money?
Right.
So once you get your head around whether it's pirated or not pirated, whether it's legal or whether it's millennial or not, you can't argue with the fact that you could have, you know, in some countries, 7, 8, 9, 15, 20 million households with granular consumption data. There's no other data source like it.
Well, you know, one of the things I've often thought is, you know, data tells me history. It gives me a map of what was behind me, how then what it means for the future so that we don't oversaturate. You know, if everything was, all these things were really popular, does it begin to get a little redundant and insular if we're only re-churning what has been in the past? So how do you, when you're advising people, because obviously there's an insights component where you're not just handing over buckets of data to them, you know, the value add is where you're looking at it. How do your algorithms look at that? And how do you ensure that it doesn't just retread?
You know, it's an interesting thing. And I don't know if you've seen this through your research, but we see that there's a consistency in the consumption of content at a household level. So and there's a bit of predictability. You know, a household is pretty consistent from month to month and not from year to year, but there is some predictability that if this household in first quarter was watching a lot of tearjerker dramas and not watching a lot of did I get that right?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that makes sense.
And not watching a lot of slasher movies, it doesn't flip all of a sudden in the second quarter. Now, you know, comparing 2013 to 2015, or something like that might. So
right. I was just thinking, you know, in terms of like cultural trends, we think of emerging trends, and you know, and so if you're, because it takes a while to get an original scripted drama off the ground, you know, how do you identify emerging?
That is, I think, a difficult thing, and I'm always admire the you know, people who can foresee into the future about what those trends might be, especially if it's a scripted drama and be able to get it through development and then produced and then right. on air or released, you know, as a theatrical. How they can do that? The best I can do is that, you know, ours is one data point. It's a very granular data point, and we can provide some context around that consumption. So we can provide things like age and gender composition of the household or income, as I've mentioned, or right. other kind of third party data things, start teasing that out. But the people that we work with that are the best at this take our data and they're mixing it in with other data to be able to provide their own modeling where they've got that baked into how they want to do it.
Right. How does this household level of granular data, how does this relate to Nielsen ratings? And do you find that everything's pretty correlated? Are there ever differences that you notice? I mean, what do you think about that?
So yeah, so the Nielsen ratings are, first off, it's panel based and ours is census based.
Well, so you're, I know, about that's why I'm curious, right? Because yours is actually census based. So
you're looking at two different things. The second is that the Nielsen, from a legacy standpoint, is going to be focused on linear television or, you know, set top box television, whether you watch something as it's happening or 2 or 3 days later, you know, as the industry knows from C3 and C7 when, right, when the content's consumed. And so what we tend to find is that ours is going to be a little bit more behavioral based and a little bit more deeper and richer in terms of the insights, where as a former television salesperson, I can tell you Nielsen's all about the currency. How many people saw it? And how can I translate that into eyeballs that I can sell to an advertiser? I'd go back to our original conversation at the beginning of the program where we were talking about this
is it volume or is it the right consumer? I mean, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes back to this original premise of, as a consumer, having relevant advertising and having engaging content that's based on my personalization without having me to fill out, you know, having to fill out a 500-page match.com form about my likes.
Well, and if I'm a brand, I'd pay more, I would think, to know that the people who are seeing it are going to be receptive to it, my brand message.
Not only receptive to it, but think for a moment that what good does showing the aforementioned millennial a luxury SUV car when they're making $38,000 and living in Manhattan do, when you should be really thinking about how to kind of version the creative for the different audiences. So it's a very powerful medium. It's just making sure it's tailored, I think, is really, you know, one of the big things.
So have you been invited in to talk or participate or give data for upfronts where people are selling ad time? Or is that still really just a ratings game and the different ad-supported networks are really using their own numbers?
It's interesting. I think at the end of the day, it's still a ratings game. You saw NBCU and Linda Yaccarino, who is a brilliant mind, and applaud her trailblazing on this, make a $1 billion guarantee. I don't know if she had her pinky out like Dr. Evil, but she made a $1 billion guarantee against audience. Now, the currency that may be traded still will be Nielsen. But it's an interesting thing that you go to some of our advertisers, even large ones like Procter & Gamble, and say, I'm going to find you new moms, or I'm going to find you established households, or I'm going to find you your audience. Now, you may buy Nielsen points, but what we're going to be able to do is tie our actual delivery back to categories and segments of audiences that really matter and really ring the register for you.
Right, right. Well, we have run through our time together.
Oh, so
it's
quick.
Been so fun talking with
Thank
you.
Thank you.
Oh, you know, wait. I have more. I do have one more thing. Do you have a few more minutes?
Of course.
One of the things I like to do with people is I say words and you just do top of head responses. Okay. So you can't really think very much about it. I'm just curious.
Okay.
I know.
I'm not particularly good at this, but I'll go.
Well, if you pause too long, you're thinking in it. I make a buzzer sound or something. Okay. So you ready?
Sure.
Facebook.
Exclusive.
Google.
Big.
Snapchat.
Interesting.
Twitter.
Granular.
YouTube.
Weird.
Ad blockers.
Eek.
Art.
Inspiration.
Virtual reality.
Out there.
Augmented reality.
Still out there.
Artificial intelligence.
Very scary.
And that's the game. See, it wasn't so
bad.
That was good. It was really easy. It's always interesting. The ones that you get sort of wildly different is like how people feel about YouTube, Twitter, and ad blockers. Those are all really different. And also AI. Some people are like, oh, fantastic. And other people are like, oh, genocide bingo. I'm in the genocide bingo club myself because I think it's a little creepy. But I'm a Luddite, I guess.
I never thought, I couldn't understand where people said, oh, I'm ready to die. And like at that point, like the robots take over, I think my life will be all right. I'll go ahead and call it quits. Punch out.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Well, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll catch up later.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Michael Scott. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.